monasteries in Japan, in one monastery practicing there. One day I went into the kitchen area and started talking to a monk there who was chopping vegetables. And I would ask him a question, and he would put down his knife and his vegetables, and he very nicely kind of replied to me. And when he finished replying to me, he'd pick up his knife and start chopping again. And then I would carry on the conversation and ask him something else. And when I finished asking the question, he'd put down his knives and his vegetables and turn to me and talk to me. And then when he finished talking, he would pick up and start working again. And at the third time that I asked him something, he kind of put down his knife and put down his vegetables. And he said very kindly and compassionately, he said, you know, I'm supposed to be working right now. And it's my practice to just really do one thing at a time. So that when I'm chopping vegetables, that's what I'm going to be doing. Just give my attention to the chopping. And when I'm talking, that's what I'll do. I'll just kind of, you know, give my attention to talking. So if we're going to have this conversation, I can't get my job done. And so that was, you know, my cue that... Yeah, very perceptive. I caught on, message. And but it was very, very instructive to me. It was kind of a very strong lesson, not in social etiquette so much as in this possibility of practicing wholeheartedly, doing one thing at a time. And he was dedicated to this. And when you in Zen practice, sometimes when you work in the kitchen, work with chopping, or almost anything you do that involves the hands, the instructions is to put your attention in your hands, or have your attention reside, your mindfulness with your hands, what your hands are doing. And so for him, that was his training that he was doing. He was bringing his attention to his hands and the chopping that was going on. And so that was kind of very, very instructive for me. And in general, in Zen practice, one of the things that I was trained in was the use of my hands, how to use your hands. And when you're eating or you're doing something in the meditation hall, actually in a lot of different situations in Zen training, and you're going to pick something up, you don't just pick it up like this, you know, and kind of, here it is. But you're supposed to pick it up with two hands. And so like a bowl, you don't just pick it up and start, you know, but you pick it up with two hands. So like when you drink tea, for example, in the meditation hall, you don't just kind of like, you know. But usually you bow to it out of respect. And then you pick it up with carefully with your fingers, kind of nicely, as if it's something precious. And then you kind of, with both hands, you drink it. And there's many things that does in the training that you're getting. One of them is that it's a training in respect, respecting our objects, respecting what we interact with physically. But also it's a training in bringing our full presence to what we're actually doing in the moment. So it was, you know, if you bring both hands to something, it's much more of your presence, therefore, that activity. If you just bring one hand there, it tends to be more casual and not so involved. You're not so involved in what you're doing. So the training then is to do things with two hands. And to this day, some things that I do, I still want to use two hands to do it. In the Buddhist tradition, when you make an offering to a monk or a nun, the usual idea is you're supposed to actually use both hands. You're not supposed to kind of go like this, you know, take it. And you're supposed to kind of... And there's a very different feeling. Even if you give it one hand respectfully, it can be done respectfully, but I think it feels more like it's something you're really doing with your whole being. It's a more wholehearted activity if you kind of reach forward and use both hands. It's like we're using all of our body, not just part of it. I learned that a lot chopping vegetables in the kitchen at Tassajara, was how much bringing my body to the activity involved my whole body, so my whole presence for this one thing. Because I learned it a little bit by noticing how much I didn't bring parts of my body to the activity. And in the kitchen at Tassajara, it was often my left side of the body was kind of heading for the door. You know, I'd be kind of... and I could feel, you know, this kind of dissonance or this... And I learned, you know, I learned to feel that split, and then I learned actually to what it was like to bring myself fully into that one activity. So using it with two hands was part of the training, and it brings presence to the activity. And one of the questions we can ask ourselves in our practice is, what is it we do with our presence? Is our presence something that we treat casually? Or is it our presence something that we are interested in and something we respect and honor, and therefore want to not struggle with it, not manipulate it, but really give it its full chance in the sun. Bring our presence to what the activity that we're doing. And this is maybe a non sequitur, but I came across this quote today by Goethe, who said apparently said, "The present moment is a powerful goddess." I kind of like that. The present moment is a powerful goddess. The sense it has for me is not only the power of the present moment, but I have this idea of a benevolent spirit, a benevolent deity. It's very wonderful. So anyway, the topic for tonight is not so much presence, but is hands. I want to talk about, what interests me is talk about hands a little bit. Because hands are a place of interaction, a place of interaction with the world and with ourselves, and a place for integration, integrating mindfulness with activity. A lot of people ask me and are very interested about how to integrate, how to include or extend mindfulness practice into their daily activity, how to do it at work or whatever they're doing. And there's lots that can be said about that. But today I just want to kind of point to the hands as being one place to do this study, to do this integration. Because often when we act in the world, some of it happens through our hands. And studying how we use our hands, what happens with our hands, is a powerful window into our relationship to ourselves, our inner life, and to the outer life. And I thought, you know, in thinking about this as a topic for today's talk, I said, well, it's not going to interest anyone. It's just a mundane topic, hands, you know. And then it occurred to me that the word mundane really means worldly, mundo. It means of the world. And in my mind, you know, saying, well, you know, it's a too mundane a topic perhaps to interest any of you. Perhaps I was participating or continuing a split that exists in some cultures, in the Western culture, between the spiritual and the worldly. Just to say it's mundane, it doesn't simply mean, you know, it's worldly. It's kind of like a kind of, it's trivial or it's boring or it's not so important. And it's kind of sad that the word worldly has come to mean kind of trivial or not so important, mundane, boring. Isn't that kind of a sense we have of the word? I looked it up in the dictionary today, but I had this dictionary I was given in 1964. and it didn't have that sense of in the definition. So I don't know if it's, you know, the meaning has slid since then to what we have now. Because the dictionary definition in 1964 was simply belonging to the world or of the world, worldly. But the split, you know, between the spiritual and the worldly. And I think those of us who are interested in bringing mindfulness practice into our activity, into our work life, into our life, we're interested in what it's like to have a mundane spiritual life. And you go to work and tell your friends, you know, how's your spiritual life? Oh, it's mundane. Well, maybe it's supposed to be. Maybe it should be. It should be worldly. It should be a matter of fact. It's something and it's very interesting thinking about this, because you're kind of the opposite of the split is spiritual or the, you know, soulful or whatever. And thinking about how book titles in late, I'm aware in recent years that book titles have been trends in what kind of words go into book titles. And you see it even in the Vipassana world. You know, for a while, spirit was a really key word, heart was important. You know, seeking the heart of wisdom, and it seemed like Jack Kornfield couldn't have a book that didn't have the word heart in the title. I mentioned that to him, and then the next thing I knew, his book Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, was renamed. Now, I don't think, you know, anything to do with talking to me. He said it was his publisher's idea. But it was renamed a Soul Food. Because soul has become the hot selling title, right? You know, hearts, you know, that's kind of, that was the 80s, and now we're into the 90s, and it's soul. So spirit and soul and heart, I mean, they're wonderful words, and they convey, I think, wonderful sentiment. But also I wonder, by giving preference to those kinds of words, are we participating or continuing the kind of split between the mundane and the soulful, mundane and the spiritual or whatever? And perhaps spiritual life, to really talk about it maturing in daily life and really in our life, is to talk about something very, very simple and mundane. If your practice is not mundane, you're missing the boat. If it's not about the details of your life, you know how you pick up your cup of coffee, how you talk to someone, how you walk, how you drive your car, how you wash your dishes, how you lay yourself down to sleep at night, all these kind of simple, how you wash your hands, all these little things. Well, talk about something more special, something profound, something deep. Talk to me about, great truths, universal truths of Buddhism, and talk to me about what great attainments you can attain, nirvana and great states of rapture and bliss. Talk to me about dissolving states of self. Talk to me about, great spiritual saints of the past and how they sat for 30 years in caves and, and sweated and, sacrificed. But don't talk to me about washing my dishes. That's mundane. But, the question, I think, is where do you find your spiritual practice? Is it in the details of your daily life? Or do you delegate the details of your daily life to something to get over with as quickly as you can so you can get on to something else that's more important? And the suggestion here is that if you're interested in the integration of really bringing your spiritual life into your daily life, which many people are, I think most people who are lay people, that's really a kind of, if not a passion, at least an insistence. You want to be interested in the very simple mundane activities and what you bring to that, what do you do. So therefore, hands. Hands seem pretty simple and pretty kind of, they use them all the time. And in talking about hands, it's a subset, in a sense, of the subject of mindfulness of the body, which Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on. I spent a few hours this afternoon with a local boy, done good or something. If a local boy does good, what does he become?
An entrepreneur?
What? Hometown hero. Becomes an entrepreneur? Or? What?
A politician.
A politician? If you're from Sunnyvale, what should you do? What? Entrepreneur? Anyway, he went to Thailand and became a monk. And he came back and we spent a couple hours walking in Restadero Preserve together. It was very nice. And he was very nice. He told me that that the monastic or the practice, Buddhist practice in northeastern Thailand is thriving still. I had heard these rumors that it was really kind of, things were not so well, going so well for Thai Buddhism. But anyway, he says it's really thriving up there and there's great teachers and great practitioners. But one of the things he told me was that the primary practice that this great tradition, northeastern Thailand, monastic tradition teaches is mindfulness of the body, contemplation of the body. And that's what the monks are doing. They often will do some kind of concentration practice first to kind of get the mind stabilized. And once the mind is somewhat quiet and stabilized, then they do mindfulness contemplation of the body exercises. Mindfulness of the body is a very, very important part of Buddhist practice. And to begin paying attention to what's going on in our body, to what's going on with our hands and what our hands are doing, is to begin entering what I call body time. Because many of us, what we live in is mind time, the time of our concepts and ideas and our hurries and our worries and our anxieties. And the mind has a tendency of spinning out of control, getting more and more frantic, more and more concerned, trying to do more and more activities, meeting more and more demands. And we can easily lose ourselves by being preoccupied in mind time, because the mind can go very, very fast. And it's not a problem to do that at times, but it's a problem when we lose ourselves. We lose our presence, lose real connection to ourselves, and lose our health because of it. Body time operates in a whole different rhythm than mind time. And I think that body time tends to be an integrating time. If we can drop down and pay attention to the rhythm and what's going on in our body, feel our body, take enough time, enough space, enough calmness in our life to feel what our body is doing, you'll find yourself operating at a different speed than if you don't do that, if you're just living in your thoughts and ideas of what's supposed to be happening. So to find some way of connecting to the body, is very powerful. And one of the ways you could do it, there's many ways, and one of the ways is through your hands. It's such a simple thing. Some kind of experience which brings us into the body. And I think a lot of what the Buddhist spiritual practice is about is coming home to ourselves in our body. What is it like to be at home in your body? If you're not, I mean, maybe it's not necessary to be at home in your body, but the chances are if you're not, you're suffering. Or it's easy not even to know you're suffering, kind of be on automatic pilot, getting more and more anxious and more until it hits you over the head. You have a tremendous headache. But to come home into our body means to embody our body, to be in our body. And it's interesting to me that to be in the present moment, which is kind of a goal in mindfulness practice, to be present in the present moment, we usually put the stress on time, you know, the present moment, to be in the present moment. But to be in the present moment is also to be in a place. And to arrive in the present moment is to arrive in a place where you are. To arrive in this body, in this place, in this room, in this seat, in this activity. And I think that place and time are closely interrelated. Maybe they're inseparable when you enter the world of presence, when you enter the world of awareness in the present moment. So to arrive in a place, to be here, where we are. So we inhabit our body, and we embody our habitat, the place that we live, our world. So the hands, our mundane hands. So the hands are one of these places in the body that's an interface between the inner and the outer world, much as our breath is. And as many of us know, that the breath is this great interface. You can feel, as our moods and emotions and thoughts change, you can feel how the breath changes. And as our environment outside changes, you can feel also how your breath changes. It responds both to the inner and the outer world. And by staying in touch with the breath and what's going on with the breath, it's actually a very good way of staying in touch with how you feel innerly and outerly with the world around you. But the hands, and the other place for that is the eyes. You know, pay attention to what your eyes do. And the eyes also is a place where this, you could feel, see the interface between the inner and the outer. Another place is posture. What your posture is doing. Pay attention to your posture for a while. And a tremendous amount of information goes on in our posture. And it's interesting to me that in the scripture, the Buddhist scripture that talks about mindfulness practice, one of the first exercises it gives is to be mindful of your posture, of the posture and different activities of what you're doing. So one of these things, like the breath or the eyes or the posture, is the hands. And a lot goes into the hands, a lot of expressivity. For our inner world, what expresses... what interests me today is that a lot of what happens in our hands expresses our inner state, or what we're trying to express. You know, if you're Italian, you know. If you're Norwegian, you're not so clear. And I have both things in me, because I grew up in both countries. And I grew up speaking Italian. And it seemed like it was impossible to speak Italian without using your hands. But Norwegian, it's fine. But anyway, a lot gets expressed in hands. And what interests me is how paying attention to what our hands are doing indicates the background state of mind, the background mood that we're in that might be invisible to ourselves. And I know that sometimes it's possible for us to have sometimes a general state of mind, general state of mood, that is so much kind of the background backdrop of what's going on, we're not aware that it's even there. And I've known people who have told me that they had a certain state of maybe anxiety that was there for years and years and years, and they didn't know it. It was just like so common, such a common thing. It was like water for a fish. It's like, you know, or air for us. You know, it's there, but you don't see it. And so certain moods can be that way for us. And either, you know, for years, or it can be for, you know, in the short term, just, you know, for a few minutes or a few hours. And sometimes we're not aware of it. And we're not aware of these things, and they have a way of filtering our experiences, causing us to feel, react different ways to the world around us, and that often has a cumulative effect on us, these background unacknowledged states that we sometimes find ourselves in. So what's interesting is the hands sometimes can express that. And if you start paying attention to your hands, sometimes you'll notice the hands will be the first indication that there is a kind of background mood or a state, or some kind of state of mind or emotion, which is operating, but you're not so well aware of. So, you know, picking your fingernails, or your fingers, you know, is one of the ways. You know, when we get anxious and nervous, perhaps, we often kind of become fidgety, and it's expressed in the fingers. Playing with our rings, you know, sometimes. Sometimes it's just idle kind of play, but sometimes it's because we're nervous or afraid or something. And there's all these wonderful, you know, gestures in the hands that we all know what they mean or something about them. You know, you start tapping your, you know, so this monk was late for our appointment. Can you believe it? So I was sitting in my car waiting for him, and at some point I noticed my hands on the roof going up out the window, and my hands were going like this, tapping, and, you know, and oh, I was impatient. And, you know, and then you go like this, and this means something usually, right? That's a hand gesture that says something. Or you go like this, it means something else. You know, or, you know, this means something. You know, we do different things with our hands that, you know, that indicate things for ourselves. You know, wringing our hands, you know. And something's being expressed. And so we know all this. I mean, this is pretty common stuff. But if you start getting a sense of this, you get a sense that the hands are a form of communication. And the degree in which the hands are a form of communication, they then communicate not only to the outer world, but they also become a communication back into ourselves and what our own states are. And the suggestion here tonight is that sometimes by paying attention to your hands, you can be aware of your state, your inner state, before you otherwise would be aware of it. And so it becomes a powerful window or a reminder or a place for mindfulness. And sometimes even the most trivial and subtle states of mind can be expressed in the hands. And as I said maybe some months ago, I'm also very interested that how much we'll tolerate, I think it was the word I used some months ago, but or willing to kind of overlook or not bring our attention or mindfulness to subtle states of suffering. And a lot of us have these subtle, trivial states of suffering. It's rather trivial. A little bit of impatience that some guy doesn't show up on time. You know, he's only 5 minutes late, after all. Big deal. But it's very subtle. But it's very subtle. Normally, like, you know, oh, I know. Even if I noticed it, oh, okay, you know, so much for that. And let go of it. But that's very interesting. What's going on there? To catch those and be aware of those. And not to let them go kind of unbeknownst to unknown. Sometimes people are only really strongly motivated to practice or think that the subject of mindfulness is only real suffering, you know, big, catastrophic things. But if you learn to kind of pay attention to the subtle, mundane details of your life, the subtle, mundane sufferings and problems, you'll be in a lot better place to meet with wisdom and understanding and patience the greater difficulties, the greater sufferings that arise. One of the things that's interesting is that when anxiety or tension is expressed in the hands, that it's probably also being expressed elsewhere in the body. And one of the places often expressed is in the breathing. And one of the things you can do if you find anxiety is, lo and behold, you're being anxious, is you can go and pay attention to the anxiety in your breathing. And breathe with the anxiety. Breathe into the anxiety or with it. Or just breathe consciously, feeling the tightness or the constriction. Not to change it, not to judge it, not to do anything, but simply allow consciousness, conscious awareness, to be the salve that kind of lubricates the situation. So you can do that with your breathing, but you can also do that with your hands. I've noticed in myself that I'll fidget sometimes out of nervousness or anxiety or whatever. And what I've learned is that when I do that, there's a way in which my hands become an energy drain for me. And there's a kind of way in which my presence, part of my presence, part of my energy, is actually going out my hands. Or perhaps another way of saying it is that my attention is being split in two different places, the thing that I'm thinking about or engaged in, and the energy and the effort that's going into the hands to do something, the anxiety or whatever. And they'd be kind of a split. And what I found sometimes is that if I simply letting go of the fidgeting and letting my hands kind of be at ease, that it becomes, sometimes it feels a little bit uncomfortable for a while as that restless energy kind of moves, but it also kind of releases that energy for something else. And sometimes I'll find that release of the energy can translate itself into more clarity or more effort and more energy for the mindfulness itself. And that's a wonderful thing. The trick always in mindfulness practice is how to observe, how to be aware of what's going on within us and around us without judgment, without criticism. So what all, anything we learn about ourselves is to held in this non-judgmental field. So this is a little bit about the inner world, and then there's the outer world. The hands express how we contact and relate to others and to other things. So in this monastery in Japan, we had to, one of my jobs sometimes was to help set the dinner table. We had this long, long, long table with 40 monks sat facing each other, and we would have these silent meals together. And we put the food in the middle of the table. And my job, so I would sometimes bring the food from the kitchen out to the dining room. And when it was time to bring the rice, in the rice pot, I would just grab a ladle in one hand and start, you know, carry it down. And after all, then you can take something else in the other hand and you can do twice as few trips. And these Japanese monks got so angry with me. And it was kind of irrational. I thought, why are you so angry with me? And they came over and tell me, you have to hold it in two hands. And for them, what it was rice in Japan is kind of like apple pie in America. Or, you know, apple pie in mother or something. And it's something very special. It kind of represents Japan. So for them, it actually was more than just simply respecting the rice. It was actually respecting something that was central symbol of Japanese culture. And you didn't want to be casual with that. You wanted to have respect, and you did that by holding with both hands. So for them, what you did with your hands expressed a relationship with that for them was very important. So we do that. So we can explore, you know, what kind of relationship do we have with our objects that we hold and we pick up? Are we interested in our relationship to our mundane things that we do? Is it important? Does it have any place in our spiritual life? Or is that extra? Or, you know, that's to be, you know, as I said earlier. The hands are a vehicle for care and caring. And a lot of care and caring can be expressed in their hands. I was talking with some Zen friends, some priests at the San Francisco Zen Center last week. I hadn't been up there for a long time, and I don't know exactly why, but I was talking to one of them, and I think I was talking really fast. I have a tendency of talking fast, but I think I was talking really fast. Or maybe I was hyper or something. And another one of my friends came up to me and kind of observed that this conversation was going on, and she ever so lightly just kind of touched my elbow with her hand. It was this sense of caring, or just like, you know, kind of something. Like she was caring, and she was kind of like indicating something, and this very gentle, nice touch, and I immediately noticed, really immediately caught on what was going on. And I stopped and took a breath and continued in a quieter way. But it was very, I was really touched, literally, in my heart, kind of, with this very gentle touch, this caring touch that she was conveying something to me that I needed to know without any judgment or without any interruptions or interference. We express our, in some ways, the hand is an organ of attention and caring. And you know, we know there's a kind of, maybe a cliche, but touch is a healer. And there's people who lay on hands. And just to touch someone is to show that you're present, that you're attentive. You know, someone's distressed and you kind of touch their shoulder. And you're indicating you're there for them, you're paying attention and not alone. And it's a powerful thing to do, what you do with your hands. I like going and getting my hair cut. And I think what I like about it is the fact that someone's kind of very, kind of nicely, kind of has their hands around my head. It's kind of very soothing and nice feeling about it. Hands are places of caring, organs of caring. Oh, you know, it's interesting that we're born into life into someone's hands. Usually, most people, someone's there to catch us with their hands when we're born. And most of us, when we die, someone's with their hands is going to lay us to rest, or lay us to our final place, either where we're going to get cremated or buried in the ground or whatever. That we're born, we come in and leave the world in the care of someone's hands. And I think that not only is it, you know, literally true, we're born into the world into someone's hands, but I think it's almost metaphorically true that we're in the care of other people's hands. So our hands, what do we do with our hands? You know, there's the studies, if you know the studies about subliminal touch, several studies. One of them is the librarian who checked people out of the checked people out when they had their books in the library, and they did a study where half the people, the librarian, would kind of innocuously kind of touch them, just the person who hardly wouldn't even know that they were touched, but just kind of. And then the surveyors would be outside the library and say, you know, can we ask you about the services in the library, and you know, very matter of fact, and was librarian friendly. And the people who were touched and didn't know it reported that the librarians were, does the librarian smile for you? And the librarian was trained not to smile to anyone in this study. But for the people who were touched, a big proportion of those said, yes, the librarian smiled. She was friendly, or he was friendly. And the people who weren't touched would say, no, not particularly. And then the most interesting one was, I think it was the way it worked was at a telephone booth. I think they left a whole bunch of change on a little table underneath the payphone, like 93 cents or something. And then they'd wait for someone to come into the telephone booth to make a telephone call, and they'd see the money and they'd pocket it. And then they'd have someone come up and say, oh, I just was using the phone, I left my change here, do you see any? And what they found is, if there was a very subtle kind of touch involved, if the person asking for the money would gently touch the person who had taken it, 96% of the people returned the money. But if they weren't touched, it was a much, much smaller percentage of the people. No, I didn't see any money. So what happens? What happens? What do we express in touch? What happens there? What's the difference that goes on? I didn't think I could talk about the hands without talking briefly about mudras in Buddhism. The word mudra means seal, but it kind of means hand gestures usually. And I don't know, sometimes I wonder if I should ever talk about other religions besides Buddhism. But anyway, I have a lot of respect for other religions, so it isn't that a lack of respect. But I was very curious this week to read that the Christian gesture of praying, I guess like this or like this, that it's relatively recent in Christianity in the sense that it didn't become popular until the 13th century, and apparently. And it started to make its appearance in Christianity around the 9th century. And it seems to be a gesture that goes back to Roman times. And it was a gesture that a shackled prisoner would make, a gesture of submission, which makes some sense because an important part of, I guess, Christianity, a certain part of its history at least, was submission to God. And so this is what you're expressing, I guess, this kind of submission. So that's what I read. I don't know if it's true. And it's possible that the same expression in Buddhism has maybe some of the same background. You know, the Anjali, what is called in Buddhism, you put your hands together like this, flat together, but you actually cup them so there's a little bit of space, opening, between the palms, kind of between the thumbs here. And I'm not sure exactly why. In Zen, they teach you to keep your hands flat together. But in India, the Indian way, or the Theravada way, is to keep them slightly open. And one story I said was because it allows something to come into that, to fill it. But there's different ways of doing this. You know, one is to do it in front of your heart. And the other way is to do it above your head, like this, or up in front of your face, or like this. And the higher you put it, the more of a subservient role you have to the person you're doing it to. So if the person's really high, and, you know, Indian culture is a hierarchical culture. You know, if they... I don't, you know, it's probably fair to say, right? I mean, it's like the number one hierarchy culture. Everything's put in a hierarchy. And you see this because Buddha statues almost never do this. Because a Buddha is the highest thing in the hierarchy. And so the Buddha doesn't have to do it back to anyone. So, but anyway, so the higher it goes. So in the usual way, I think, in Buddhism, is just to do it at the heart level. And for me, at the heart level, my understanding is then you're kind of meeting as equals. And you're kind of bowing to the Buddha nature, to the other person, just as they bow to your Buddha nature. And it's a beautiful expression, I think, to do this. It expresses something different than shaking a hand. And shaking hands expresses something different than this. And they both have their place. There are times when it feels really appropriate to shake someone's hand. And it seems like that's what's called for, kind of a real meeting of real kind of contact and camaraderie. And I don't know, it's kind of like sharing a camaraderie or sharing a kind of agreement or sharing certain kind of, I don't know what. But this is more a sense of gratitude, of respect, of reverence. And sometimes that's what seems appropriate in a situation, to express that. Or honoring someone else, honoring the Buddha nature in them. Honoring. I think actually this is kind of, to me personally, this is a deeper way of expressing my connection to someone else than shaking a hand. But they each have their place.
I had read before that the gesture of shaking hands with the right hand came from a nobleman practice in the medieval period, and it was a way of indicating that I was weaponless.
Yes. So you're coming harmlessly.
Right.
And so that comes to the next mudra, which is the Buddhist mudra for harmlessness is this. It's a gesture of fearlessness or offering, dismissing fear of protection. And you see many Buddha statues standing, being like this. The same idea. You're safe to approach. And I think, I was trying to remember today, I see how mindless I am, but I think like when dogs come running and attacking you, isn't it kind of natural to kind of show them your hands are kind of bare and harmless? Or like there's something, yeah. It's kind of almost like instinct to do that. So I think some of these things are almost instinctual, you know, or some of these gestures. There's another one you see in Buddhist statues, which is kind of like this one of fearlessness, but it's usually the left hand, and it's pointed down the same way, this means generosity or compassion or giving, kind of offering, welcome. And then there's a teaching mudra, which is usually like this. This is one of the ways. Sometimes with both hands, like this, is a teaching mudra. And then there's a Dharma Chakra mudra, which is probably maybe more like that one. I think it's I don't know what he's doing, but he's teaching. But I think that anyway, it's more complicated. The mudra that the Buddha used when he first taught the first time he taught the Dharma. There's some special mudra. So you know that when you see statues like that, that's what it's representing, is the first teachings of the Buddha. And then there's the one very famous in Thailand. A lot of the Thai statues have the earth-touching, Bhumi Sparsa mudra, where you're touching the ground, touching the earth, which I think is a tremendously profound symbol. To touch the ground, to touch the earth. And you know, depending how you see the earth and what that symbol is, what the earth symbolizes, and what it means for the Buddha to call on the earth on the night of his enlightenment. And if the Buddha is kind of symbolic of a relationship that we have, and a relationship we need to establish ourselves with the earth, with the ground, as we practice, perhaps. So, yes?
Kind of an aside, but I'm wondering, you know, in meditation, at least popular visions of it, you know, a lot of times people sit like this, or just in mindfulness, you suggest like this, and it's just, I'm wondering where those come from, because they really, for me, seem to really profoundly close the loop on the energy that otherwise just seems to drift off.
And some people feel that. You can experiment sometimes, especially if you find yourself quite settled and concentrated in sitting, and quite open and sensitive, is then to experiment. And you can see, you can feel actually, maybe energetically or mood-wise, subtle differences between if your hands are facing up or facing down. Or if you have your hands together here in front of you, and what it all means, I don't know what these means, you know.
I think it tends to be
Hindu practitioners tend to do this more, though. You know, in our tradition, we say you can do whatever you want. We're kind of, you know, all goes kind of tradition, I think in Hinduism seems to be much more. Maybe Terry? Is Terry here? She go home? Terry's our yoga. Or Sarah? Sarah, no. Yoga. And but the Buddhist, the meditation mudra for the Buddha is like this. And traditionally, it's with the right hand on top. So the right fingers are kind of overlapping the left fingers, with the fingertips touching the base of the fingers. And then the thumbs lightly touching and forming a kind of oval between with the thumbs and the first fingers. And usually up against your stomach or resting on your thighs like this. And however, in Zen, they put the left hand on top. But the tradition is to put the right hand on top. And now why, I don't know, except the religious reason that they gave me when I came to Zen Center is that the right hand on top, right hand apparently symbolizes wisdom, and the left hand symbolizes compassion. And you want to have compassion on top. Compassion is more important, maybe. That's kind of what I heard. Did you know, you know, is this what you've heard? Something like that? Close enough? Yes?
The explanations I've heard come through the tantric model and the explanation of the mudras with fingers touching and as well as the full lotus is that it closes the energy circuits so that nothing is lost.
Yeah. It could well be that, and that's what...
circulation of energy through the nadis.
Uh-huh. So that could well be. And you can feel, you know, there's something really marvelous that happens Buddhism in general, except for tantric Buddhism, general Buddhism, exoteric Buddhism, tends not to be too interested in adjusting the inner energy and getting just the right asana and the right flow and all that. Because it can be a distraction. It can actually be a crutch for practice and get in the way. Because you can get a lot of power and a lot of concentration from the posture. But then you're not really... You're confusing that kind of state of power, concentration, with the mindfulness that brings freedom. So the general Buddhism tends not... You know, like Vipassana, which is kind of like general Buddhism, tends not to focus on doing anything real too specific with posture, but allowing the inner development to happen from the strength of the mind, of the awareness, rather than from anything particular thing the body is doing. But, you know, if you sit in full lotus, and then you bring your hands together like this, and then if you let your stomach relax, and you keep your attention down here as you breathe, there's a tremendous focus of something, of energy, of posture, of things, in this area right here. And usually in Zen, you're supposed to keep your attention about 1.5-2 inches below your navel. And you sit in full lotus, it actually helps quite a bit with your back, keeping you a lot easier for your back to sit in full lotus. I mean, one of the best things you can do for your back is sit in full lotus. It's kind of, but it's one of the worst things you can do for your knees. And I've used this if I get really sleepy. I've used this because it's like, you know, it can be like a rush of caffeine. It really has a powerful effect. To sit this way and to sit upright and feel the energy kind of move through the body. And I've used it sometimes as a crutch. I didn't like what was happening in my meditation. And I said, well, I'm just going to kind of blast my way right through it. And that's not particularly wise. But there is, you know, posture is a tremendous, posture is a tremendous thing to pay attention to. So in mindfulness, we just pay attention to posture, we just pay attention to it. We don't do anything with it particularly. If you want to get into it, you know, you can. But it's a little bit tricky. And tantric Buddhism has a whole other thing they're trying to do besides, you know, besides freedom. So, and the last thing I'll say, if I may, one of the things, thinking about this the last few days about hands, I became aware of how often I and other people used words with the expression hands in it. You know, give me a hand. Or, you know... what?
First hand, third hand.
First hand, third... What's third hand? Third, like... Like second hand.
Parties.
Or third hand.
Yeah,
oh. Second hand. Hand. Third hand. And but the expression that I want to just kind of end with is the issue at hand, because it's kind of a beautiful term for understanding mindfulness practice. In mindfulness practice, we're trying to pay attention to the issue at hand. And I like it because it's a tangible sense. What is tangibly the issue at hand? What's really here right now that's really going on? What's the issue at hand? What's the tangible thing you can actually touch and experience right now? So, you know, thinking about the future or thinking about what happened in the past has its place in life, but they're not. What's actually happening in the present moment? What's the issue, tangible, felt sense issue that's going on right now? And I think what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is to always ask ourselves, what's going on now? What's the issue at hand? What's the most intimate thing at hand? What's closest at hand? Closest at hand in our experience. So you're sitting here and you feel, you know, you feel a certain way. You feel maybe you feel sleepy. So you say, well, what's the issue at hand here? And so, you know, what's closest at hand? In this experience of sleepiness, what's closest at hand? Closest at hand is a kind of feeling around the eyes and the heaviness and whatever. And or if you feel depressed, what's closest at hand in the depression? Not your thoughts and anxiety, but what it means. What's closest at hand maybe is the sense of, you know, of heaviness in the shoulders, perhaps, or I don't know, something. And we're always asking ourselves, or looking, what's the issue at hand? What's the closest thing at hand in our given experience that we're trying to pay attention to right now? Maybe my epitaph can be my gravestone. And giving his rather mundane talk was to sensitize you a little bit to the possibilities around paying attention to hands. And not to tie yourselves up, you know, but just to kind of pay a little bit of attention to what's going on with the hands. And use that as a way of integrating your mindfulness or applying your mindfulness in the activities, the things you do in your daily life. So thank you. Ha 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 ha